The University of Montana football program is being penalized for violating NCAA rules. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. We'll also have an update on the Mill Creek fire west of Missoula, which is looking a lot better today. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce takes us to the Pets and Dolls Parade in Great Falls. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a former corrections counselor about the war on drugs. NCAA today released its long-awaited report on the university's football program. Reporter Edward O'Brien has the story.
The report found several violations, including that UM and former coach Robin Flugrad allowed two football student-athletes to illegally receive free legal services, and other players to receive benefits ranging from small loans to free meals from boosters. The infractions will cost the football program four scholarships and place the program on 3 years of probation. The program will also have to vacate wins in the 2011 season that the two ineligible student-athletes participated in. Current athletic director Kent Haslam says that includes giving the conference trophy back.
Reference to the conference championship that was won that year, our appearance in the playoffs for that year, all that will be removed from public display, and those wins will be taken away from our overall win total and for the overall win total of the head coach at the time. I mean, we've got a Big Sky Conference trophy, so we'll return that, and we'll take out all references that we had to the playoff appearance and to the conference championship.
Former coach Robin Flugrad, now an assistant at Weber State, will be suspended from coaching for the first game of the fall season and faces recruiting restrictions. Flugrad and former athletic director Jim O'Day were fired by President Royce Engstrom in March of 2012 for undisclosed reasons. Much of the case revolves around the October 2011 arrests of cornerback Tremaine Johnson, who now plays for the St. Louis Rams, and backup quarterback Gerald Kemp by police trying to break up a loud party. Officers used stun guns on the players. The NCAA found that a booster bailed the two out of jail, and an attorney provided each with about $1,500 in free legal representation. The NCAA said Flugrad learned a booster had posted bail but did not report it to university officials. NCAA officials also found then athletic director Jim O'Day and the compliance director were aware that a booster was providing legal assistance to the athletes. Current athletic director Kent Haslam says the university is committed more than ever to fostering what he calls a culture of compliance.
We have, over the last 9 months, implemented significant changes into the way we go about our compliance, the way we monitor things. We've hired another compliance assistant that his whole job is to track and to monitor. The rules for the NCAA are complicated. There's no doubt about it. And I think this report shows that when you read the full report, that we're dealing with a lot of very intricate and detailed rules. But we've implemented a lot of changes already where we're better at monitoring things. We're better at keeping track of what's going on. So during the probationary period, we need to report back and make sure that we let the NCAA know we're fulfilling the responsibilities and the penalties that they imposed.
Haslam says he's happy the investigation is over. President Royce Engstrom echoes that and says he believes the campus is, quote, stronger, safer, and more vibrant than ever, close quote. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Edward O'Brien.
And in other news from around the state, firefighters are feeling a lot better today about the 720-acre Mill Creek fire that broke out yesterday between Frenchtown and Missoula. A heavy initial air and ground attack yesterday saved several homes, and today all evacuation orders were lifted. The fire is about 30% contained, and crews are working to build more line on the fire's northern flank in anticipation of stronger winds tomorrow. About 175 people are working the fire, including a crew from the state prison. The fire was started by a spark from a lawnmower hitting a rock as a young man was trying to mow some tall weeds behind a residence above Mill Creek Road. Information officer Forrest Morrill says the spark ignited the very dry grass and took off.
Just like starting kindling for your campfire, smaller fuel like that takes off really fast. Then the fire was pushed with the wind and burning into that grass. Those fuels are really what we call flashy and quickly ignite and quickly move. And that's what the fire did. It almost started to just roll its way up the mountain and into that perfect V shape that's up there now.
The fire spread north and east within 100 yards of several homes off Bunchgrass Road before air tankers dropping retardant stopped it. A radio tower was spared, though the fence around it was burned. The fire has also burned into an area burned previously by the Black Cat Fire, and that also helped slow its spread. Chris Johnson is the fire prevention officer for the Lolo National Forest. He recommends that if you have tall weeds to clear, it would be safer to use a string-type weed whacker than a lawnmower.
The mower's got that blade that spins around fast, and if you're taking it through ground that obviously hasn't been mowed maybe in months, you know, that's how the grass got that tall, you're probably not going to see that rock that's going to cause that spark. And it may not kindle. That spark's going to stay hot as you walk away. You get 10, 15 feet away. I don't know how far this young man was away from where it started, but he was obviously far enough away that he couldn't then go over and stomp that thing out. It probably had, you know, 4 to 8 foot flame length by the time he even recognized it. By then, you know, it's pretty much too late.
Johnson says it's also a good idea to have water on hand if you're doing some clearing. He says of the 60 fires that have started so far this year on the Lolo Forest, 56 have been human-caused, mostly from clearing debris or escaped campfires.
On one hand, we applaud the measures that these homeowners take, even this time of year, but just heightens the fact that they've got to be prepared for a fire to start if you're an activity that could start one.
Stage 1 fire restrictions are due to go into effect August 1st. Officials warn fire season is really just getting started. While 20 miles southwest of Phillipsburg, the 200-acre Moose Meadow fire is still burning out of control. Information Officer Arlie Staley says several areas are under pre-evacuation notice, meaning they should be ready to leave within 24 hours' notice. Those areas are Moose Lake, Copper Creek, Creek Campground, Frog Pond Basin, Zeke's Meadows, and Sagebrush Flats. The fire was caused by lightning. Nearly every community has its signature summer events, rooted in tradition, passed down through generations. Festivals celebrating local food or music, 5K races with peculiar themes, and lots of parades. Great Falls is no different, and last night, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce attended one of that city's longest-running traditions, the annual Pet and Doll Parade.
And the parade will begin in 5 minutes.
Central Avenue in Great Falls is taking on that idyllic glow of early sunset. Costumed little kids line up in their respective lanes.
This is our 79th annual parade, and it is the cutest thing that you'll ever see.
Patty Reardon.
I'm the Deputy Park and Recreation Director.
She helps organize.
Pet and Doll Parade's just been the traditional name that we've had for all these years, but we have every type of character, every type of animal.
There are 8 different categories, like sports, circus, frontier. Pets have their own category. And there are 10 or 12 different classes judged within each one.
Best costume, matching costume with largest animal.
That's Alex Smithson describing the subcategory he entered with his 4-year-old daughter, Rainin, and his 5-year-old tortoise.
His name's Sheldon. He's a spur-thigh tortoise.
Together, they dressed like Ninja Turtles. Sheldon's 21 pounds. He's sitting in a wooden wagon. Contestants take any number of strategies to get their more unusual pets down the 8-block parade route. As it begins, the few hundred spectators see a little catwoman with her feline on a leash, ducks in a cage, and a miniature pot-bellied pig named Seamus, riding in one of those strollers people attach to the back of bicycles. Pushed by adults Seth and Kristen Johnson.
3 little pigs.
And little Kennedy Nicola is dressed as the big bad wolf, complete with a werewolfy mask she has a hard time talking through.
Oh, I can't really do it.
Bruce Davidson is watching from the sidewalk.
I'm a 1966 first prize winner from the Pet and Doll Parade.
He says it felt like an old tradition even back then. Times have changed. He says the actual doll category used to be a much bigger deal.
Oh, there was all the girls had their dolls out.
Not too many dolls anymore. And the prizes have changed.
We won 10 silver dollars. I'm serious. Now it's all about the blue ribbons, you know.
There are a lot of ribbons. Every kid gets a participant ribbon, and then each one of those dozen or so subclasses within the 8 categories gives out a first, second, and third place ribbon. 4-year-old Ninja Turtle Rainin is walking the parade route, waving with her dad and their big tortoise, Sheldon. She won a prize.
I see you have a ribbon there. Do you know what kind of ribbon you got?
A blue one.
What does a blue one mean?
It means cold.
means cold.
More about the experience, I guess. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting from Great Falls.
A retired Oregon corrections counselor who also worked as a parole and probation officer says America's war on drugs is an abject failure. Shelley Fox Loken says states should have the authority to decide whether they want to legalize drugs that are now illegal. She predicts that responsibility legalizing drugs would result in decreased violent crimes and drug use rates, while simultaneously benefiting state coffers. Loken is a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a group of law enforcement officials opposed to the war on drugs. In tonight's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, the now retired Loken says her thoughts on drug policy stem from observations gleaned from her long career.
After I graduated from college with a degree in criminology and a minor in psych, I got my first job as one of Oregon's first female officers in their all-male maximum security prison. At the time that I got the job, I didn't realize that that's where I was going to be working. I thought I was going to be working at the women's prison. So it was quite a shock to me. So I worked there for 4 years, broke down some barriers for women and that kind of thing. And then from there, I went into parole and probation work in Eugene, Oregon. And I was there about 11, 12 years. And from there, I went to the newest prison in Oregon, Snake River Correctional Institution in Ontario, and was a release counselor, a prison counselor, while I was there. Mm-hmm. And then I retired. I'd had enough.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a tough career.
It has been very tough. And I think one of the toughest parts is all of us go into this business with very altruistic ideals. And we generally want to help people. And I think where the problem comes in is, what does help really look like? And we've stumbled around for the last few decades trying to figure out what help really looks like. What many of us in the law enforcement arena have discovered is, help does not look like locking people up for drug abuse. Mm-hmm. That is not helpful to the person who's being locked up. It's also not helpful to the community. It actually detracts the positives from the community for the sake of punishing someone for a consensual crime.
Let's go back a step, actually. When sure. I think of a prison population, mm-hmm. a certain image comes to my mind's eye, and probably it's a common one across our civilization, maybe. Mm-hmm. Who are these people?
When I first started working in the Department of Corrections, the drug war really hadn't started taking off yet. It was right before that, as far as in my community and funding and that kind of thing. It had been declared, but it really hadn't. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Right. So I started in 1979 in the prison. At that time, we only had three prisons in the state of Oregon, 2 men, 1 woman. Now we have, I think, around 13 to 15. And all of that expanded population can almost exclusively be accounted for drug crimes, for consensual drug crimes, either somebody buying it or somebody selling it to somebody who wants to buy it. So what we began to see was an explosion in the prison population, and we saw a corresponding increase in taxes for the citizenry, who then has to foot the bill for building more and more prisons, more and more local county jails as well, because those populations also swelled. And as we have increased penalties for these consensual crimes and imposed things like mandatory minimums or other kinds of directives to judges in how to sentence, as opposed to letting the judges use their wisdom, because of all of those factors, the population has continued to grow and explode. Back in 1979, the majority of our population was not there for drug crimes. We had many there for drug crimes even then, but not the vast majority. Now, I don't have any statistics right now offhand on Oregon's current population breakdown, or Montana's for that matter. It would be interesting to look at, though, to see what proportion are there for person-to-person crimes, which are the ones that most of us think of when we think of prison, which is the people who are in there for murder, for assault, for rape, for child molesting, for sex abuse, for theft, for burglary. These invasive crimes where there really is a genuine victim that you can easily identify and who is asking for help. That was the majority of the population, the prison population, in the entire United States. Since the drug war was declared, that population has just increased so much that it has become an increasing burden to every state to house all of these people. and to not only house them, but also to offer the services that they need when they get released. And they will get released. And what we have done is we have taken them oftentimes out of a stable, other than drug use, a stable environment that they've managed to create. And many drug users are able to do that. Many people who use drugs are not dysfunctional. But generally, if they come to the attention of the authorities, there's something dysfunctional happening. Otherwise, they wouldn't have generally come to their attention.
Something dysfunctional happening, meaning?
Meaning they've committed a theft, they've neglected their children, they've gotten in a car wreck under the influence, you know, any of these things that brought them to the attention to the authorities.
If that's drug-related, that's a problem.
Yes, but instead of holding them accountable for the behavior, such as the driving under the influence or the theft and that kind of stuff, we tack onto that. And we're also going to penalize you for being an addict, which is a medical condition. Many of us in the law enforcement community, and those of us especially who have retired, who've spent a lot of time locking people up for being a drug addict and nothing else, we have come to regret many of those activities because we feel that we have not only helped damage those people's lives, but damage the lives of all the people in their contact circle, their spouses, their children, their siblings, their parents, their employer. And we've taken them away and punished them for being an addict. We don't give them any treatment, or if we do, it's probably the worst treatment that's available.
Like what?
Well, I'm talking about drug or alcohol treatment. Uh-huh. And the treatment programs generally that are in the institutions. They're not necessarily worse as far as their programming, but because of the environment and because they're only with other inmates and stuff, it has been shown not to be a very successful avenue. Now, the county jail system's a little bit different as far as their utilization of community treatment programs because they can do that. But the state system has to keep people confined in their facilities, and therefore that's where the treatment is. They don't get any real world experience, for one, in using the skills that they're supposed to be learning. But anyway, statistically, it just doesn't do as well. Programs in the communities are much more successful. And so we don't have, you know, a perfect solution or a magic bullet for, you know, the drug abuse problem. But what we do know is that making drugs illegal and making the criminal justice system deal with what we think is a medical and social problem just creates more problems and costs the taxpayers a great deal of money, and also has even more far-reaching impacts on society as a whole. By keeping drugs illegal, we are funding the drug cartels, who are in turn funding terrorist organizations. We can show a direct line between drug prohibition, the drug cartels, and
Al-Qaeda.
Yes, a direct link. These are the kinds of ways that real criminals support their enterprises, is through selling drugs. We can't arrest ourselves out of this problem. Americans do have substance abuse problems, and my organization does not advocate that people should be using drugs or abusing drugs. We're not in favor of that at all. But we do think that leaving drugs to the black market has created more problems and created more harm to society as a whole than dealing with it in the medical or social arenas.
When you and your colleagues in LEAP talk about drugs, what are you referring to? Pot,
well, we're talking about every drug that has a law prohibiting its use, the illegal drugs, basically, and that includes pot. And in fact, pot funds the cartels probably more than all the other drugs combined. They make more money off of pot than they do any other drug. So if you took just that one away from them, that would deplete their resources substantially. But if you took all of them away from them, they have nothing.
So then what do you propose?
We propose that states get together with their thinking caps on. We don't have a model to present for people because we strongly believe that each state, or maybe even communities within the state, need to draw up their own model with some guidance and help in looking at other places that have started doing some of these things. When you take away the law enforcement angle, you increase the education and the treatment angle. And one thing that we've learned here in the United States is what works best for keeping people from starting bad, harmful behaviors is really good education and messaging. So, for instance, when they quit advertising for cigarettes and they started educational campaigns, we started seeing a decline in the teenage starting up of smoking rates. And that has steadily continued to decline. When alcohol was prohibited under the law, we saw an escalation in the rates of alcoholism. And as soon as that was repealed, we saw a decrease. One of the reasons is that when young people have a more difficult time getting a hold of these substances, they're not as likely to become addicted at the young ages where it's more difficult to, well, you just set a life pattern at a younger age. Alcohol is harder for kids to get than marijuana because the state regulates it, because the state has so many regulations and rules in place that, yeah, there's going to be some kids who get alcohol. That's always going to be the case. That's why we have laws. Otherwise, we wouldn't need laws if everybody was doing what they were supposed to be doing. But when the state regulates it, it works better than when the drug dealers regulate it.
And yet, alcohol is regulated, taxed, et cetera,
right,
et cetera. And it causes misery and heartache and death.
It sure does.
Every single day.
And that was the whole argument of the prohibition movement. It's not going to be perfect. Nothing is perfect. But kids certainly don't have a lack of access to any drug that they want right now today. And there are people out there actively trying to recruit them to use the drugs so that they can increase their profit base.
So you and your colleagues would be okay for states exploring the possibility of taxing, regulating, selling marijuana?
Absolutely.
Cocaine?
Yes.
Heroin?
You know, every single one needs to be analyzed. Every drug is not the same. We need to have medical people on these committees deciding how we administer these drugs.
I personally never thought I'd see the day when recreational marijuana use would be legalized. Two states as they're gearing up.
Two states and possibly Oregon will be following because Oregon's looking at their next door neighbor, Washington, and saying they're going to get all our money.
Did you ever think this time would come in your lifetime?
I actually did when I was really young. And then when I worked in the system, I thought it would never come. Certainly, attitudes have changed over the course of time as different generations have come into power. But I did think that eventually, especially for marijuana, because there is no science justifying its illegality, and there's a great deal of science justifying its legality and how it is helpful medically. Other than maybe, and the jury's still out on this one, an increase in emphysema from smoking. But that's with any smoked substance, clove cigarettes, you know, whatever. It doesn't have to be tobacco.
Shelley Fox Loken, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Thanks
yes.
for your time.
Thank you.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight expect mostly clear skies with lows in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow will be mostly sunny with highs in the mid-80s to lower 90s. Sunday calls for mostly sunny skies in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. Highs will be in the upper 70s to mid-80s. For central Montana, tonight will be mostly clear with lows in the mid-50s. Saturday calls for sunny skies with highs in the upper 80s to 90s. Throughout the night, there is a chance of thunderstorms and rain showers. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds. Sunday, expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be in the upper 70s. And for southwest Montana, tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with isolated showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be in the upper 40s. Tomorrow will also be cloudy with a slight chance of thunderstorms that may produce gusty winds. Highs will be in the upper 80s to 90s. Sunday, expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of thunderstorms. Highs will be in the upper 70s. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Roberts.
Beginning on October 1st of this year, just about 2 months away, Montana and the rest of the country will begin a process which will radically change how many people shop for and buy health insurance. Most people have heard of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, though a survey just a month ago showed that up to 40% of Americans still believe that it has been repealed or is not going to take effect. This points out the problem of a major new law which many people simply don't understand. The ones who could benefit the most are probably the least likely to get it. Education about what all this means and easy access to actually buy health insurance will be essential to making the whole thing work. In Montana, there will be three health insurance companies offering products on what is being called the healthcare marketplace. This was previously called the exchange. Each state has different insurance companies offering products for that state's marketplace. Some areas may have a choice of up to 15 different plans, while other states will have just one company offering insurance. Starting October 1, anyone will be able to go to the internet site and see what is being offered in each state and how much it will cost to buy health insurance from the different companies. The options will range from relatively inexpensive catastrophic coverage for young and healthy people, all the way up to very comprehensive but more expensive insurance. A major part of this whole program is that no one can be denied insurance coverage because of an existing illness. Rates will be different depending on age, but everyone in the same age range will pay the same amount. Smokers may be charged more. Medicare is not affected, and people who are now getting health insurance through their work will mostly not be affected either. In our state, there will be a group of poor people who still will not be able to buy health insurance. Our legislators made a choice not to provide Medicaid insurance to individuals earning less than the federal poverty level, which is about $11,400 a year for an individual. People earning more than this may receive significant financial help to cover the cost of buying health insurance. For example, with these supplements, young people earning $15,000 a year may be able to purchase insurance for less than $15 a month. The higher the income, the older the person, and the more comprehensive the plan, the more it will cost. Still, compared to the current cost of individual health insurance, the cost of the insurance through these marketplaces, even without subsidies, is looking like it will be significantly less. To help us all understand exactly what we'll need to do to sign up, there will be folks around who are trained to lead the process. Many should be able to do it themselves on the web at healthcare.gov. Right now, you can get many of your questions answered at this site. Starting in October, this is where you will go if you want to actually look at your Montana options and buy insurance. The Montana Health Co-op website now has a simple calculator which helps you figure out about how much financial help you can expect to get based on your income, age, and family size. Our state insurance commissioner, Monica Lindeen, will have information on the insurance department website. A number of people will be specially trained to lead others through the sign-up process. Many insurance agents will become certified to help individuals, families, and businesses sign up. Counselors will be trained and available in many of our health clinics and state offices. People called navigators will have extra training and will be in most major Montana communities. Overall, we expect to see well over 100,000 Montanans eventually use these services. Many of these people currently have no insurance or are buying very expensive insurance with high deductibles. Some small businesses may decide to drop their employer-based insurance and instead pay their employees a little more to purchase insurance on the marketplace. We do expect it to take some time, but finally we're going to make insurance available and affordable to many people who have been left out. Hopefully our state legislators will see the benefits for this for all Montanans and work for ways to provide this insurance to the 50,000 people who will not qualify without federal help through an expanded Medicaid program. Thanks for listening. This is Dr. Tom Roberts.
Tom Roberts is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.